Too thin for a shroud. On the 8th of June, 1982, four British warships came under an unexpected mass attack at the end of the Falklands War. Two were sunk, 56 Army and Navy troops died, more than half of them Welsh Guards, and close to 200 men were injured. Some 300 veterans suffer from PTSD to this day. It is the subject of a new book called Too Thin for a Shroud. It's edited by Martin Reinger. I hope I said that correctly, Martin, as he drives me live on the line from somewhere in the UK. Martin, good morning to you. Did I get your name right to begin with? Let's get this going for a start.
No, that's perfect. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Correct. Thank you for that.
That's sort of my pleasure is mine. Give me a little bit of background then to your involvement with Too Thin for a Shroud what exactly refresher. Well, it's embedded, isn't it, into the national conscience, I think, what happened on that day.
Yes, I think so. Well, the same thing for me. I think so Crispin Black is the author of the book. And he's a long-standing author of mine. And he first did a book on 7/7, and because he was one of Tony Blair's spy offices at the Cabinet Office, and he wrote a little book on that at the time. And then he wrote several thrillers after he finished that job. And so he came to me last year, and he said, "You know, I knew this. I was on the Galahad, which was the ship that was blown up on the 8th of June. And Simon Weston was also on that ship as one of the famous last survivors who came out of the hull of the ship and alive. And and I knew that." And he said, "Well, it's the 40th anniversary and I want to do a memoir of this. And, you know, do you want to do it?" I said, "Sure, why not?" I mean, I like him. He's a charming man. But I did think, well, what are you going to write about? Because we know that, you know, for the Falklands War was a great success for Margaret Thatcher. And we know about Simon Weston. So what more is there to say? And, well, he said, that's where it started as just sort of me saying, "Well, you know, I know you and I like you and why don't you write?" But then he said, "Well, I found, you know, one of the things about it is that we as the Welsh Guards, we started out being described on that day in the news reports on the 8th of June as heroes, people who were bombed while we were trying to, you know, say liberate the Falklanders, and but over time, instead of us being seen as part of the success story, we've been blamed for that day as if it was somehow our fault." And I said, "Well, I didn't really quite, that's very strange, and you have to, you know, that sounds really wrong. First of all." And you have to explain to me how that works. And what he said to me, "Well, look, there's on the Imperial War Museum website, there's a quote from one of the land commanders. And he says, well, if I'd been on that boat, I would have swum ashore." And this is Julian Thompson. He was General Julian Thompson. And I thought it was really rather shocking because what you're saying effectively is, well, you know, you guys, the Welsh Guards on board the Galahad, you missed a trick. You know, instead of being blown up, you should have jumped overboard and swum ashore. And surely for a commander to say that is rather, you know, it's
yeah,
not very respectful.
Disingenuous, I'd say, to put it mildly. And at that point, it's all very well. It's like, you know, it's like, what was it? Trump famously said he would have run towards an active shooter. Yes. Until you're actually in that situation when literally all hell breaks loose, you don't know, A, what your actions would be. You might, until you've been tested yourself, you might freeze, for example. There's well-known situations that are happening. And B, yeah, you know, it's chaotic. You're a trained military, you know, you're a trained service person. And perhaps you are waiting for that order, or things have happened to disembark, or whatever. Otherwise, that's what distinguishes a militia from a unit.
Exactly. Well, so that was my instinct, because I'm a failed lawyer. So I just thought, well, you know, one of the points about being in the army is that you are you know, you obey orders. So if it's so for a general to say, I mean, he was a brigadier at the time, but he's a general now, and he was a general when he said it in 1991. You know, to say, okay, look, guys, you Welsh Guards, what you should have done is just ignore the whole structure of the army, you know, where orders are given, and instead, what you should have done is you should run ashore, dropped everything, your mates, your friends, your whatever, and jumped leapt into the water. You know, apart from all the other practical things, how difficult that might be with your, you know, your heavy kit, your guns and your stuff, and how to get it off and while the, you know, bombs are flying. It's just bizarre and disingenuous and, you know, shocking, really. And so I thought, well, you've got a point. You've got me interested. And so, you know, you have to explain, you know, why don't you write, you know, I rather look forward to this book and seeing how that, you know, how that came about. And one of the other things about it that he said, which obviously piqued my interest as well, is that he said, because of the passage of time, there is a whole raft of, you know, of documents that have been recently released. You know, they cast another very different light on the situation as it's been told so far. So I thought those two things were very good starting points for a book. And it became a sort of a detective story where he was investigating what he knew of the day itself, because he was there. Mm. A bomb flew, you know, right past him. There was three or four bombs, I think four. Galahad was bombed by four bombs. He was an officer, so he couldn't go on the first boat. His duty was to check up on his troops and to make sure that they were all, you know, whoever was injured had to be helped and made sure that, you know, it's like, I suppose in that situation, you're very much like the school teacher who has to make sure that all the children are accounted for.
What was the situation with Tristan and Galahad? Were they waiting to disembark? Was that why it was unexpected? Because they weren't expecting to get hit, were they, in that particular, because they were a fair way away from Port Stanley, and also this wasn't sort of the opening day of the landings. This was presumably they were being bought in to take part in the land campaign, and other units were already, you know, this is while they're doing the famous yomp across most of the Falkland Islands.
Yes, you're very well informed. Yes, no, exactly, and that's so. Well, the reason for their move to Fitzroy. Bluff Cove, really, was that the next day was going to be the beginning of the attack on Port Stanley, or the liberation of Port Stanley. So it was quite an important moment, and they were part of some five or six brigades encircling Port Stanley. So they were the last piece to be fall into place before all that. And this is the sort of curious thing about it all. So they were, as in risk, you know, the whole, everyone was about to be lined up. But the way the story is told, if you read about it nowadays in books, it's sort of as if what happened that day wasn't the biggest military loss of Britain in during the First World War. Since the Second World War, it was as if something just sort of minor, you know, happened on that day where, you know, sadly something didn't go according to plan, and that is the thing that really is the heart of the book, is, you know, why is it, on the one hand, and that's the title of the book, why is it on the one hand the worst military day for Britain, and why don't we know about it, and what actually happened on that day? And so they remember it to be that they arrived and it was a beautiful day, and so they all thought, well, you know, this is if we can see the enemy can see us. And so it really is a moment to the book describes almost minute by minute how that was possible, how they were attacked.
The other thing is the fact that and I talked about that the impact it had on the British public, if you like, those images, because an age before social media, and also the images that we got weren't real time, but we still got them pretty soon afterwards. And this wasn't an attack that happened in a landing zone on a first day where no cameras are there. It didn't happen out at sea with something being submarine. This happened literally in and the film crews had, if you like, this horrendous grandstand view of what was happening. Yes. We remember the helicopters going into the front and picking out the guy in the survival suit. We can see the explosions, and it's so close that there's a certain helplessness. And this was another thing. And then the story is such as Simon start to come out of those who survive. We've got the images of people being rushed to the carriers in all sorts of trouble, and I think that's the word I can possibly use on this one. And again, for a campaign that seemed to be we're going down to this is going to be over, and it was almost like a Victorian campaign war, and you know, chaps doing stuff over there. Suddenly, this was brought back much more fiercely into the national psyche. You know, that war is a nasty, dangerous, and extremely bloody business.
Yes, I totally agree. I mean, one of the reasons why the cameras were there, ITV was there, was because on camera, because the next day the attack would start, so everyone was sort of geared up. It was like, in a way, that if you, it's a very good comparison. It's a social, you know, early version of a social media war, because it was all, you know, they were there because not because the military thought, well, it's too dangerous. They thought, well, we need to have a grandstand where we can show how fantastic all this is going. So really, one of the things that the book uncovers, it's like the elephant in the room. That what was supposed to have been this magnificent final piece in the Falklands War, that day, you know, the day before that grand, you know, the grandstand, the finale, was actually the biggest disaster. And why did that happen? And that is the curious thing about it. And it's one of the things that really for Crispin made a difference, because they were subsequently blamed for it, which is, you know, a bit weird, because
I suppose the thing is that we don't realize, as in all, you know, the old saying, you know, no plan stays intact after first contact with the enemy. So you can have all the plans you want and people dropping into place, and then they're going to move here and they're going to move there. And, you know, 40 years back, we can go, okay, so the Falklands campaign was this, this, and this, and we took Stanley back, and the Argentines had a Malian conscript army who weren't willing to fight, et cetera, bad morale and motivation were absolute low. But we didn't know that at the time. We, you know, this is the same thing when people talk about the Second World War. We had no idea what was coming up next, and neither did the forces. They, for all the people who were entering Stanley, who were crossing the Falklands, they could have met a really sort of hardcore bunch of people.
Well, exactly, and I think there's an interesting thing, because one of the if you look at when the Argentine Air Force, which was extremely good, by the way, it was the one of the most effective pieces of military, equipment is not quite the right word, but the Argentine had. And the attacks took place during the first beginning of the war, when Sheffield was bombed with an Exocet rocket as in retaliation of the Belgrano. And then, you know, which is a terrible loss for the Argentine Air Force, Navy. And then when San Carlos was attacked as the first landing, but there was no attack, Air Force attack subsequent to that for the next 10 days. And so I think, I mean, what it suggests is that the military commanders thought, well, you know, the worst is over. We can relax and we can now, you know, take our time to move our pieces into place. And we can have the cameras there. We can have all the journalists there. And what they can then do is write up this really wonderful report. And that's not what happened.
That suggests, that suggests an overconfidence from the British military planners, because the Argentine pilots, having been stuffed at their first meetings with the British forces, was obviously taking time to regroup and get their heads together, because they'd been suffered huge, you know, tragic losses.
Yes, and so I think that's, if you just look at the number of when the Argentine Air Force attacked, you see that all the previous 4 or 5 days are in reaction to a British offensive move. But this is the first time the Argentine Air Force attacks off its own bat for the first time. So basically, if you think of it as chess moves, it's a loss of pace by the British military, because instead of them pushing the Argentine military into a corner, it was this time that Argentine commanders pushing back and inflicting, I mean, it's extraordinary, the worst military loss on Britain in a day since World War II. And that's not a story, of course, if you are a general or an admiral, that you want to get out into the open, because it doesn't do very much for your career.
Yeah, and I suppose the other thing is the fact that Britain hadn't, I mean, up to this point, the British forces had really only been involved in what you could call counter-terrorism or counter-insurgency in Malaya, in Oman, in Korea, in Northern Ireland. So this is the first time that there's been a large scale, if you like, this sort of maneuver since the end of hostilities in the Second World War.
Yes. No, I think it is, you're absolutely right. It was a test. And one of the things I want you to also point out, because it's, you know, with a book like this, which is trying to tell a story in a new way, is, you know, one shouldn't really discount at the same time that the beginning of the war was an enormous success, really, because it was, 25,000 people were mobilized in a short period, space of time, to, you know, get them 8,000 miles across the Atlantic, the ocean, to, you know, fight a war. It's the logistics are just amazing, and so one of the things about it is that it, on the one hand, so that it's a I suppose it is, if you're doing something for the first time after a while, you know, you can, you know, some things go well and some things won't go well. Well, this day was when it really, really didn't go well at all. And the pigeons came home to roost. And I think that's the, and that's not in itself, a negative, but it is a story that needs to be told. And I think particularly if I were a Welsh guard, I wouldn't want to be blamed for that day, because that would be, on top of the fact that you are still suffering from the results. I mean, one of the things about, we're not really made for being shot at and being bombed. You know, it tends to have a bad effect on one's psyche, and so, you know, to we would now say it's bullying, because you are basically, you're telling people who are not in a great position to defend themselves, you know, because you're trying to deal with all that stuff, you know, basically it's all your fault. You know, that is just not the right way to tell this story.
And imagine the shock, though, if you are one of those Welsh guards. You know, you've gone at 35,000 miles across the world. You've gone onto a troop carrier. You're expecting to disembark. You're with all your mates. You're fully packed up. All you think you're going to do is get off the troop ship, go onto dry land, and then start the campaign. And suddenly, out of nowhere, wham! And all hell, I mean, not even hell, just the horror breaks loose. 56 killed, burns, you know, wounded men, ammunition going off left, right and center. Nothing in your brain can, no matter how trained you are, when that happens, the perceptions of reality just go out the window, because it's just total shock. And we're seeing that now as we do recognize, thank goodness, the people suffer from PTSD, because before that, you were expected to fight the war and just get on with it and quietly suffer from shell shock when you got home.
Yes, no, exactly. And I think, well, you know, when there's also parallels with what's happening in Ukraine. It's just, it's terrible, really, because it's, you know, it's not just bombs. And then the next day it's, you know, you are, there are no bombs. It's something that, that stays with you. And I think that is for the Welsh. I think one of the things about it is, you know, these are all people who wanted to do their job and do it properly. And so one of the things that the book describes is, you know, for the first time, is really how they, what happened on the deck, and how discipline just kicks in, because that's what you're trained for, although it's terrible. So there's a moment where Crispin, he's one of his troops is there with, you know, because it's the heat, face melted. And he asks in a very British way. He asks, "Well, how are you fine?" And the guy says, "Yes, I'm fine." And it, you know, there's a lot of these moments which have gone lost in this narrative, whereby it's all about who is to blame for this. Whereas in fact, you know, they were doing their job. They did it actually very well. The discipline. I mean, there was lots of people who helped also once after the bombing, the helicopters and everyone else chipped in. And it was a magnificent effort to, but the Welsh Guards weren't there, like Julian Thompson said, jumping overboard and screaming and yelling. They were acting in the appropriate way. And so it really is also, it has many layers to the story as well. It's, you know, what happens to people when something like that happened? How do you remember it? And one of the interesting things about it is that it's like being on the Titanic. You know, you remember that moment every day of your life. So Crispin has dreams where he describes this in the book, where those few seconds, those moments, are replayed, but weirdly, they're never the same. They're always slightly different. And he says, well, if only they were the same, you could get bored with it. But he can't. When one of his dreams hits him, it's always new and it's always ghastly. And, it's really there are very many moving moments like that where, because he's written it with four other officers who were on board and who described their own events during the day, and how, you know, the bombing itself and how they coped with it. So there's a mixture of military history as well as the actual it has on you as a person.
And also, I suppose the thing is, there's a couple of things. I mean, Simon Weston, incredibly brave man, and how he rebuilt his life. But to a certain extent, and I don't mean this in a derogatory, but he became, if you like, the figurehead of the Welsh Guard experience. And with the greatest of respect, everybody went through stuff on that day. Simon was hideously injured, and he was a miracle he survived, etc. But there are so many other tales to tell, because you could say it was very convenient for the MOD to have somebody as brave and heroic and go, that's Simon Weston, that's the Welsh Guards experience, now leave it alone, we move on.
I think that there's some truth. I do think that the Simon Weston story is quite a... I think that there is something... quite special about that story, because it is, there's a resilience there, and there is, it is an inspirational story no matter which way you turn it, because if you can turn your life around and make something out of a really horrific experience and not be bitter about it, and I mean, you know, obviously there's a lot of helping hands, but I think he also had a really bad patch in his life where he was, you know, trying to, where he was, you know, he was angry and where he, you know, where he didn't feel quite so cheerful and as he is now, if that's the right, I mean, he may not use that word himself, but, you know, he seems very well put together now. And I think it's the struggle. So I think there is a, I agree with you. There are many stories. And one of the most interesting things I heard was one of the people who is involved in the book. We met at his house, and he told the story, and his wife happened to be there. And, he left for a moment to get a drink. And his wife said, "I've never heard this story." And it's extraordinary. The way people cope with extreme trauma like this is very personal and very private. And I think one of the interesting things about the book is that you get an insight into this, stories that they may not even have told their closest, the people closest to them in their lives.
We're going to run out of time, as you can guess. I could probably talk to you, Martin, about this for the next, three or four days. What do you hope that people will take and learn from the book Too Thin for a Stratton? And where did the title come from, by the way?
Well, it's because he has a coat, and when he's on deck, one of the things he does is someone who's pulled off his coat because it was in flames and it's freezing. It's the Falklands, and he gives his coat to the man, but he doesn't know whether he survives. And he says, "It's too thin for a shroud." I think that one of the things I certainly hope is that the story as it's told of that day moves away from the fact that the Welsh Guards were somehow involved in its calamitous, disastrous, effect that day, because they didn't. They were just there to do their job.
The book is called Too Thin for a Shroud. It's available to download from our own TRE bookstore. It's been Martin Reiner. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. I've got 3 seconds from the news. Thank you so much for your time today.